Thank you very much. Thanks all for having me here. And yeah, it's very nice to be here in Perimeter. I'm going to talk about RG flows in 4D Chern Simons and integrable 2D theories. So if you want, you can try and think of an alternate title. Could be like 4D Chern Simons, a naive quantum field theorist's take. You know, there's not going to be any complicated geometry, this kind of thing. So you can, you know, you can relax. So it's based on a couple of papers, one from this year, one from last year, and a paper in progress with my collaborators, Anders Valberg and Sylvain Lacroix. So integrable signal models, I guess, date back, you could maybe link them to this Pollmeyer reduction. So Pollmeyer noticed, starting from some ON-type theories, you can make some kind of reduction of the phase space to land on Sine-Gordon, or some kind of cousins of Sine-Gordon. So you get some, from this sigma model type theory, you get some model which you know, so some integrable field theory in two dimensions. And so this ON model, right, it's like something like strings moving on a sphere. It's a special case of this class of 2D quantum field theories called sigma models. So they're just some scalar field theories with all two derivative interactions. And so these scalars Xm are interacting through some matrix, G plus B. And G is symmetric and B is anti-symmetric. So here I'll be thinking of QFTs in a flat 2D space, and I'll use this light cone notation, plus minus. So we'll be interested in the particular case of special choices of these target space geometries, G and B, where these 2D field theories happen to be completely integrable. And so at the classical level, you should ask for something like the equations of motion taking this canonical zero curvature form. So somehow there should be some object L, the Lax connection, whose zero curvature repackages up the complicated nonlinear equations of motion of this field theory. Right, so you see it's a complicated theory because, you know, these G and B, they depend on X. And of course, an important place where these sigma models have been useful in recent years is in string theory. So you know that string theory in curved backgrounds is very hard. In generic cases, the string motion will be chaotic, and there's sort of, it's hard to say anything. But in some special cases in curved backgrounds, the string spectrum, for example, may be related to an integrable problem. So this, in particular, this 2D sigma model may happen to be integrable. And the big success story, you know, where this has given a huge amount of mileage is the case of strings on ADS5 cross S5. And so there, you know, people discovered this sort of amazing integrability on the gauge side of the holographic correspondence. So the spectrum of single trace operators in N equals 4 can essentially be solved using these integrability methods. So naturally, many authors have asked, can you modify this setup while preserving the integrability? So you might think you should try a different dimension, ADS space, try and break some of the supersymmetry maybe, or do something like deforming the geometry. And so I guess deforming the geometry is kind of, that's the kind of spirit of what I'm thinking about in this talk. And so just to show you the status of these ideas about how to deform the geometry, I show you this confusing mess, a table that I made. So I'm not actually, this principal chiral model in this column, it's not quite the theory which is related to ADS5 cross S5, but it's close. And here I'm just showing you there's a bunch of deformations that exist. People were quite innovative. They dreamed up some kind of elaborate deformations of these highly symmetric sigma models that preserve integrability, at least classically. You know, so people were innovative. They came up with these cool deformations. You'd have to say that a systematic understanding is lacking, and it's all very confusing. Yeah. I put a lot of question marks because where's the organizing principle? What's going on? In general, we have this huge space of geometries, and we basically don't know which of the geometries correspond to integrable sigma models. On the other hand, I can show you this very simple 4D theory, which is supposed to engineer some or maybe all of these things. So, you know, I go from a very complicated mess to something very simple. It's just one equation. So Costello, Witten, and Yamazaki, and I also should have actually in some earlier papers of Kevin, they proposed this 4D theory as a sort of some unifying framework for integrable models. So the idea is somehow inside this 4D theory, I'm going to try and engineer all these different integrable models. And maybe that can give me a good systematic understanding, or a way to understand the landscape of these theories. So just to kind of give a lightning introduction to this theory. So it's sort of semi-topological, semi-holomorphic. So the topological direction are just the 2D coordinates. They're going to end up being my 2D space. I'm going to make some kind of reduction. And I'm kind of adding a geometrization of the spectral parameter. So you know that in these integrable 2D theories, there's some complex spectral parameter. So we're sort of adding, the idea is to add that to the space-time, to make a 4D space-time. And I'll always be taking, in this talk, the spectral parameter to be in CP1. So this is just basically a Chern-Simons 3 form, wedged with some meromorphic 1 form in the spectral directions. And so the idea is that all this complicated stuff about what theory you land on in 2D, it's just encoded in the choice of this meromorphic 1 form, and perhaps also some boundary conditions. If you start putting poles in the 1 form, you're going to have to put some boundary conditions for the gauge field. So here we're just going to have boundary conditions and some zeros and poles of this 1 form. That's it. So just to give a cartoon, we have zeros and poles, and at the zeros, so since this thing in front of the action is vanishing, the fields in the action can start blowing up. Right, so you should think that zeros of this 1 form, phi, of this phi z dz, there's some very wild points, right, because the 4D gauge field can start blowing up to compensate the vanishing of this phi. And on the other hand, the poles of this 1 form are going to be the place in the Z plane where the 2D theory is going to live. Yes?
Oh, can we go back to the last slide? Because I'm confused with, this slide.
Yeah.
So that is coordinate on the CP1.
Yes.
But I can see you have not written down explicitly, but it is also integrated.
Yeah, I'm integrating over the 4D space, right?
Yeah.
So this is a 4 form. This is a 3 form and this is a 1 form. And so I'm integrating over C and...
So you just simply missed it.
Sorry?
You missed the C. It's
up there.
Yeah, it's here. I'm integrating over it. Right, this is a 4 form.
Right. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Yep. So you see, I should highlight... Thanks for bringing me back here because I forgot to say... You see that the Z component of the gauge field doesn't really appear because it's always wedged with DZ. Right, so we just drop it. Okay, so this is the cartoon. But I guess I should caveat, and I should also caveat that I'm not an expert in those matters, but I caveat that in some kind of closely related context, so with some different kinds of defects, which are called order defects, whereas this setup I'm dealing with here, these wild points, they're called disorder defects. So here we're in the realm of disorder defects. But on the other hand, in a related setup with order defects, perhaps there have been more quantum arguments why this 4D, 2D relation should go through. And also in the context of lattice models. But here in this context, where I really allow this meromorphic 1 form to have poles and zeros, so I'm going to try and really engineer 2D field theories on the nose, I would say that, at least as far as I understand, the argument how to get from 4D to 2D has been made classically. And then you may ask, and certainly if you ask some kind of old school integrability person, what do you think about this? They might say, but I'm a bit skeptical. Like, are these things really the same at the quantum level? Can you compute one loop beta functions of some integrable theory, principal chiral model? Can you compute them in 4D? They might be a bit skeptical. And we know that there can be set situations where you have some theories which look classically equivalent, but really they're defining different quantum theories. And certainly in the presence of these disorder defects, which are really wild. One way to see that they're wild is that they're kind of like, if you reinstate the h-bar, it's like h-bar goes to infinity at those points in the spectral plane. So you may worry, you know, you might be defining the wrong quantum theory if your goal is to study the 2D theory. And so I'm going to argue, indeed, like, what I'm going to be doing in this talk is making a kind of first quantum check of this proposal, in this context with disorder defects. So I'm going to derive the one-loop beta functions of integrable sigma models, starting from 4D. So the plan will be first to review the classical equivalence, and then second, I'll talk a bit about integrable sigma models and their one-loop RG flow. And finally, I'll make this matching argument between 4D and 2D. So any questions about the proposal before I continue? Okay. So how does it work, the equivalence between the 4D theory and these 2D integrable models? So here I'm kind of reconstituting what I understand from the literature, right, about, you know, what's known about how to build these theories from 4D. So I look at this theory, and, you know, classically what's going to be important is the equations of motion. So I write them down. It basically just, sorry, this is there's some typos going on here. So ignore this L. Forget the L. So these are F is the field strength of A. Right. So the equations of motion are basically that all of these components, these three non-trivial components of F, vanish. But they're kind of weighted by these factors of phi. So phi times F vanishes. And one thing you can do to kind of try and see the integrable 2D field theories popping out is I make a change of variable. So I kind of, it's like a gauge transformation. I'm writing this AZ bar as some pure gauge thing. And now under the gauge rotation, A plus minus, so these plus minus are going to become, these are some directions in the 2D, the eventual 2D plane, right? So plus minus are just some light cone directions in 2D theory. So this A plus minus becomes, just gets rotated. I'm calling the rotated version L. And by doing this change of variables, you see, because these Fs transform covariantly, these two of these equations just become the statement that phi times dz bar of L plus or minus equals zero. The two of the equations just tell me that this L is meromorphic in Z, and its poles can only be at the zeros of phi. Right. So when you hit the poles with dz bar, you get a delta function, and this needs to be cancelled by zero phi. And the other equation, you can just strip phi off, because all the z dependence is fixed. And so the last equation just tells you that this L has zero curvature. So you see this looks very good. This is exactly what you want for the equations of motion of an integrable 2D field theory. You have some meromorphic one form, and it's flat. Okay. So it looks exactly like we're getting what we want. Again, this is another typo. This C is, forget the C. So yeah, I've written it here. If phi has zeros in some places, then at those places and of the same order, I can have poles in L. And this L is going to become the Lax connection, right? And then the other equation tells me that Lax connection has zero curvature on shell. So this is exactly what you want for integrable 2D field theories. So that's good. And I just note that this other field, G, right, I just made a change of variables from A, right? I started with A, and now I changed variables to G and L. So L is becoming the flat Lax connection, and G is just pure gauge, right? You see that the 4D theory I started with has the standard 4D gauge invariance. So I can use that gauge invariance to just fix G to be 1. Okay, so G is going to be pure gauge. So that's good. You know, I don't want some extra degree of freedom rocking around. I just have the 2D degrees of freedom. But it's not quite so simple. So you see that there's also a boundary term when you vary this 4D action. And so it looks like this. And you see that this thing, dz bar of phi, localizes to the poles of phi. Right, so I get some boundary terms at the poles of phi, and that's the place where my 2D theory is going to live. And so you have to put some boundary conditions to kill these terms. And this has been studied quite elaborately. So these guys told us at least some big class of sufficient boundary conditions. And in the end, what they end up telling you, right, so I've called the residues of the poles of L, these poles being at the zeros of phi, I've called the residues A, these curly A. So curly A is some 2D currents which appear in the Lax connection as the coefficients of the different poles. And so basically what's going to happen is that while I said G was pure gauge, actually the components of G at the defects, they still appear in the boundary conditions. And without going into the details of this complicated boundary condition story, these people tell us what's going to happen is that those 2D currents in the Lax will be fixed in terms of the defect values of of this G field. Right? So in the end, the value of G at the 2D defects is not really pure gauge. It's the value in the bulk, which will be pure gauge. So I can set that to 1. And you know, long story short, what happens is that the 4D action on shell, it really coincides with some 2D action. And you can build this sort of large class of 2D theories in this way. And the theories you get seem to be associated with so-called affine Godin models. So this is all a bit formal, a bit complicated, but the point is just to say that, you know, the 4D action localizes on shell to be equal to some large family of 2D actions. And which 2D action you get depends on the choice of meromorphic one form and choice of boundary conditions at the poles. Any questions about that? While I remove my computer. So look, you're all giving me kind of blank looks. I'm so worried I'm losing you now.
So that's the theory.
Yeah, they're all covered. I actually don't know any examples that aren't covered. Yeah. So you might then just conclude, okay, probably they're all covered. You land fully on their action, not just equation of motion. So that's, I guess, the non-trivial part, which I'm kind of hiding. You know, you can show that you can build this huge family of 2D actions. You just kind of gauge fix in 4D, blah, blah, blah. You get the 2D action. It's kind of an on-shell statement, because I'm kind of solving equations of motion. Sorry? Yeah, it's like you're kind of doing the integral in the z directions. You know, you just do the integral, and you get some 2D action left. So that's kind of what I'm going to come to. That's like what you want, right? So the point is, a priori, we don't know. So this is all classical, and now I want to try and start going to a path integral. I'm only going to be able to go to one loop, you know, because it's kind of hard.
Can I say that might not be wrong?
Yeah, sure.
Gauge parameter, it's a function of all four coordinates, or just the...
Yeah, all four coordinates. Yeah, exactly. So I can really set this to one. This field, which may in principle depend on all four coordinates.
So here, the function f has multiple poles, it just means that you have multiple separate...
Yeah, it's like the kind of theories you end up building are like a bunch of group-valued fields interacting with each other. Bunch of principal chiral models plus deformations interacting with each other. That kind of thing. And so they're kind of living on the different brains, but they have interactions. Yeah. Okay. So let me now talk about integrable sigma models. So these things we're trying to engineer. And my aim is going to be to derive their one-loop beta functions from 4D. So first I should understand their one-loop beta functions. This is based on this paper from last year. So the sigma model RG flow is this nice kind of geometric flow. It's going to be geometric because they have this kind of elegant geometric interpretation. So at the one loop order, it's just basically a Ricci flow of the target space metric plus some kind of anti-symmetric terms. So this H is the field strength of the B field. But Friedan and other people worked this out a while ago. So then you might conjecture, and people have conjectured that the integrable theories, right, if in this big, complicated space, infinite dimensional space of theories, if there are some genuine integrable models, right, some complicated subset of this big space corresponds to real integrable theories, you expect those theories to be sort of self-contained at the quantum level. So they should have their own RG flows, which are like consistent truncations of this flow, right? So you think that the integral models should be renormalizable, right? And indeed, let me show you that for that zoo of crazy examples, that messy table, let me show you that actually happens. So the examples I was showing you, they're all of this class. So the lax connection has this particular meromorphic dependence on the spectral parameter, two poles. And so the plus and minus components, they have different poles. And so now if you just take that form of the lax, these curly A can just be some arbitrary currents. You compute its curvature, you see there are two things, two terms. So the divergence of A and the curvature of A. So for a model to have a lax connection of this type, on shell, there needs to be a flat conserved current, A. Okay? And so indeed, simplest example would be this principal chiral model. So it's just trace of the Mora-Cartan one-form squared. So this is just the sigma model on a Lie group. Okay, that's all it is. And this is an example of this type where this flat conserved current is just the Mora-Cartan one-form. And in all of these cases, people managed to show that they all have flat conserved currents. So these eta and lambda deformations are some kind of symmetry-breaking integrable deformations. And indeed, in all these cases, although for these guys it's really not clear based on global symmetry alone, you know, the miracle happens. And this Ricci flow gets truncated consistently to some flow of the finite set of couplings of these theories. So if you look, for example, at this eta deformation, you have h, the radius, and a deformation parameter eta, and those things can absorb all of the one-loop divergences. So these theories, at least at one loop, they're renormalizable. And now if, like me, you, for some reason, spent some time staring at these things, you might get curious, because you notice that if you choose to write these flows as the divergent terms in an effective action, right, just take the RG derivative, t is the log of the scale, just take the RG derivative of the action, see how it looks. You see that it sort of looks like something built out of these flat conserved currents. Right, this is like a squared, and this again is like a squared, a plus a minus. Okay, and so yeah, you spot this. It's just trace a squared, and now you go to the kind of crazy examples where you have no idea what's going on, and it's still true. Okay, so it kind of makes sense because you know we expect these theories, we expect integrability to be kind of controlling the RG flow here. Right? The spirit of why they should be renormalizable theories. It's because you know the hidden integrable symmetries are constraining the flow. So indeed, it makes sense that this A, which is basically related to the lax connection, it makes sense that this lax can kind of build for you the one loop flow. And so that's my claim. So the claim at the top of the slide is that for any theory with a lax of this meromorphic form, with just these two poles, the one loop divergent terms in the effective action will be precisely this trace of a squared. And this CG is just the Joule-Coxon number of the group, where the lax is valued in the algebra of that group. OK, so I can try and sketch for you, if time allows, I'm being very slow, why this claim is true. So I can prove this. And I can also prove a more general claim that for any choice of poles, right, you just put any poles in the lax connection, under certain assumptions, the one-loop divergences will be sort of fixed universally in terms of those currents, A, that appear in the lax. So in particular, they don't depend on the form of the currents, A, in terms of the physical fields of the theory. Right? So in any example, you see that A is something, you know, some complicated stuff in terms of the physical field, G. It doesn't depend on any of that. Right? This formula doesn't depend on the form of A. But any questions about this statement?
like a further reason to think that integrability is preserved by energy flow?
Well, suppose you have some theory which you know is integrable at quantum level. Then, you know, it's a fully consistent quantum theory, so the flow is just, you know, it should incorporate a flow. It's just some QFT. But yeah, here now I'm kind of taking semi-classical limit, right? So this statement is something like, maybe you say classical integrability is enough. You know, one loop RG is a very classical thing. So yeah, I'm not sure exactly. But I don't know if that answers your question.
This series, it's not that they're integrable quite well.
No, actually. I mean, these deformed models that break the symmetries, the quantum level, not so much is known.
Also, integrability exists on some quantities, so that they're on a matter of the scale.
Right. Right, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Yeah, what about cosine models?
Sorry?
You can also add an engagement, like cosine model.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, here I didn't focus on it, but yeah, you could.
Also,
yeah, yeah. Cosets the symmetric spaces. So they're integrable if it's a symmetric space, which means that it's some kind of slightly technical condition about the which kind of subgroups you can pick. G over H, where certain commutators have to vanish.
And also, you're playing also.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and so one more question. Is it true that all the integrals of motion can be constructed using these Lax operators in this theory?
Using the Lax?
So you have Lax operator, integrals of motions can be constructed.
Well, there's kind of, people talk about two kinds. There's these things which you build from the monodromy of the Lax. But also, there's these. There are these local, higher spin charges. I'm not sure in general if it's if you can really make the statement like you can build those. You can always build those from the Lax. But in these affine Godin theories, I think they can build from the Lax in some way. Sort of residues of traces of powers of the Lax.
Yeah, and this is can be defined also on the quantum level. Is there no like quantum divergence which just?
I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. The thing is like. These theories are all, I should have said, the kind of theories you build with these disorder defects, they're non-ultra-local, the 2D theories. So they have derivatives of delta functions in the Poisson brackets, which is a sort of famous obstruction to making some direct integrable quantization. So a lot of what people do is a kind of bootstrap approach. You know, you just try and bootstrap an integrable S matrix with the right symmetries, this kind of thing. So I think not so much is known about how to deal with these things as quantum theory.
But mastering embedded in Fritsch and Simons, as long as each glass is not broken at each individual defect, then it makes sense in contribution to each bar. It will be integral in contribution to each bar.
Yeah, I hope so, but aren't you worried about these disorder defects?
Well, each disorder defect has to be checked individually, but I'm saying that if I have dictionary disorder defects at work, then I can build many more models.
I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. I like this idea. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have to ask you about how to do it.
For the existing defects, that's good. Based in theory, you need it. But it's just Simon's system had a formation of some centrifugal gown or some planes. So if you put transverse planes and then you have those defects, it makes sense in theory that they will survive for the formation.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I like the idea of this approach, yeah. So so what's the idea? Why should this be true? These universal statements about the one-loop divergences. So it's very simple. It's just that you know that equations of motion basically determine one-loop divergences. Just some determinant of a linearized equation of motion operator. And you know the equations of motion are fixed in terms of the Lax, right? The Lax just tells you they take this canonical form. So that means the one-loop divergences should take a canonical form in terms of the Lax. Okay, so you're done. The only subtlety is just that these zero curvature equations, I call them ZC, they're these equations which follow from, it's like some list of equations that follow from zero curvature for all values of spectral parameter. they're not all real on-shell equations. Some of them are actually true off-shell. They're like Bianchi identities. And you know, the split between the on-shell and the off-shell, this little s and sigma, it's not universal, right? So it depends a lot on the theory. So just to give you an example, this principal chiral model case, you know, divergence free is the equation of motion, and this Bianchi identity, the zero curvature equation of the Morikawa 1 form, is true off-shell, right? See, this is pure gauge. This is G inverse dG. So this is just true off-shell. F of A is zero. Whereas now, if you add a Vesumino term, these equations get rotated into each other a bit, right? So this split is kind of non-universal. And the point is that the previous slide, this logic applies to the on-shell equations of motion, but it doesn't apply straight off the bat to the Bianchi identities. You know? They're not in this game.
If you work in a PV formalism, would you automatically kind of
graphs? Yeah, probably it's just equivalent to what I'm going to say. Yeah. So maybe I just even skip the detailed argument and just tell you the informal argument. Yeah, it's a bit less elegant, I guess, than what you're saying. Informally, you just see, like, you can see all the effects of these equations if I put them inside correlation functions. And, you know, Bianchi identities, they're just true. So they're zero inside correlators. Whereas the equations of motion, they'll give some contact terms inside correlators. But the contact terms come with h bar. So it means that the leading order, you compute the divergences, this contact term won't show up. It will show up at two loops. Okay? So that's a very simple argument. I have also a path integral argument, but maybe for purposes of time, I just skip this. I kind of presume it's probably equivalent to what you have in mind. But I should just highlight, like, to make this argument go through, that the difference, the one loop divergences, they don't see the difference between things which are true on shell equations of motion and equations which identities that are just true off shell. They don't see the difference. And to make that argument, you need to make some assumption. So it's a bit technical. The assumption I need to make is that all of these off-shell equations, these Bianchi identities, things which are true off-shell, they all need to be in the lax. So the zero curvature needs to have all of them. And if you try and tell me that the currents appearing in the lax, that they satisfy some other identities off-shell that are additional to the zero curvature equations, then you stray out of my realm of understanding. You're kind of putting in some external equations. For all I know, they're kind of horrible non-integrable equations, so I don't want to deal with them. So all Bianchi identities, all off-shell identities, must be part of the zero curvature equations.
I don't know if you can help, but you know, the Frobisher sound transaction can also be looked at if you add higher form terms to A. If you write A as the sum of forms of all degrees, then the place inside anti-fields, ghosts, and then, you know, it's a full bit yatra. Maybe if you reduce that thing,
you wouldn't need this.
You might be able to get an argument that somehow you don't get extra Bianchi identities.
Yeah, maybe.
So in the 4D, is very nice, neatly packaged.
So what I have in mind is like something like Sine-Gordon. In Sine-Gordon theory, you have some lax, but the things in the lax, they're not just like free algebra-valued currents. You have to just put in by hand that they're like something like d phi, cos phi, you know. So like there's some particular things, functions of the field, physical field, and those functions are not specified by zero curvature. I don't know if that.
That's
right. Yeah, we can. I'll come to it later. So the path integral argument. The idea is basically just, you know, what do you have to compute? It's just the log determinant of the linearized equation of motion operator. So this is just what I get if I expand my fields around a background. Right, so I sort of had it on the previous slide. I expand the physical fields x around some background. And you know, the quadratic term, the operator appearing in the quadratic term, this is the linearized equation of motion operator. Well, I need to compute its log determinant. And the point is, another way to compute that determinant is I just put twice as many fields. It's just quadratic, right? So it's all very simple. Just put twice as many fields. I put some u's as well as fluctuations of y. And I put the u's, I put u o y instead of y o y. And this is the same up to a factor of 2. which I highlighted in red. Okay, it's just another representation of the determinant. And now you see I've basically recast equations of motion as Bianchi identities. Right? They're being imposed by Lagrange multipliers. So this is like the volume of solutions, y, to the linearized equations of motion. Now I just have to add in the Bianchi identities. So when all is said and done, I get this formula. I'm kind of skipping some details. So I get the volume of flat connections. That's it. Expanded around some background, where I've fixed the pole structure. So in my path integral, the pole structure, the z dependence of the lax connection is fixed. And I just end up with the sort of, as far as this makes sense to write it down, the volume of flat connections with that pole structure. So you see that in the end, we got something universal. It just depends on this list of zero curvature equations. It doesn't depend on that non-universal split. And this, I can tell you, is much simpler to compute than this Ricci flow. This is just like one line. You just draw one loop diagram, and you compute this. Any questions? OK. So I'll just show you, say, in the principal chiral model case, I told you there are two equations. dA is 0, and f of a is 0. So I impose them with Lagrange multipliers. I compute the volume. All right, so look, this gives me some trivalent vertices. This gives me a propagator, so I can only do one thing at one loop. I just get this diagram, and it gives me the formula I told you. Okay, very simple. So even for these complicated eta lambda deformations, it's all the same, just one computation. Now you can start adding some labels. Say I put many simple poles in the lax. You just do the same thing with ij labels. You get something like this. So now it's just kind of summing over different poles, basically the same formula. And there you can check in examples this is correct. There are, of course, also some examples which are more closely related to string theory. But I'll just say that, yeah, in the kind of most general case, the kind of curiosity is that there's a very nice formula which applies seemingly for all pole structures. So the divergent term is in the one loop effective Lagrangian. They're given by a contour integral of the lax. So here I've got trace of L plus dz L minus. That's what you get. And this contour should sort of put all the poles of L plus on one side and all the poles of L minus on the other side. OK? Yep.
We should start with a Gregorian eye discussion. Conjecture of two different loop on the data in some examples. Flow is given by integral of only that.
I'm going to come to it at the end. Yeah, they're just equivalent, I think. Yeah, I'm not sure right now how to see their equivalent, but we convinced ourselves with Sylvain and Anders. Yeah. So I think this is kind of a slick formula. It applies to all the pole structures. But now I've spent a lot of minutes wittering away about 2D. So now let's talk about 4D. So yeah, you may think these formulae could have some 4D origin, because I'm talking about the volume of flat connections with a given pole structure. I could also implement that with a 4D Lagrange multiplier, U. I'm integrating over four dimensions. I'm integrating over lax connections with fixed pole structure. And I impose zero curvature with that Lagrange multiplier. Okay. So I put in quotation marks because this is a priori not super well defined. So it looks like, I should be able to derive something like this, explain what I mean by it in the 4D Chan Simons theory. Because in the end, this is basically the equation of motion from 4D Chan Simons. Okay, so let's do that. So this is the subject of this recent paper. And so I just kind of do the same tricks in 4D. I expand around some background. I should have said A, the gauge field, I'm expanding it around A bar. And the fluctuation is little a. Okay, I stop at quadratic order, because at one loop you only need to go to quadratic order. And so again I get some operator O appearing, and I've got to compute its determinant. Now I put a prime, because there's going to be some gauge. You know, I should only trace over gauge invariant states. So here I'm using these indices MN, which run over the indices of the gauge field, plus, minus, and Z bar, And we know we're not integrating over AZ, the component of the gauge field, which I told you doesn't appear in the action. Right, equivalently, you can just gauge fix it to zero. And so now I can just make the same trick. I just write down this alternate representation of determinant, where I impose equations of motion with Lagrange multipliers, these u's. And so the equations of motion are still this phi times f equals zero. Okay. So I'm just imposing those equations of motion, and you know I'm kind of, to be honest, I don't know how to quantize this 4D theory. I'm a bit naive, so I just kind of quotient by my ignorance. I just write gauge downstairs. You know, you should fix the gauge at some point. Okay, but like, I guess the idea here is to just not bother making a proper definition of the 4D quantum theory, but just to show that if there is one, then you know the things I'm going to say are true. Okay, so if there is one, you can write down this alternate representation of the determinant. Now I'm going to make the same classical change of the same change of variables I made classically. Right, so you kind of just rotate. You send A to G and L, just this same kind of gauge transformation type thing. I can't quite call it a gauge transformation because there's this problem at the defects. And now I can equivalently just fluctuate G and L. Fluctuation is gamma and little l. And so then now it's nice because in this exponent, G disappears, right? We said it was kind of like pure gauge. So I just get these equations imposing meromorphicity of L, and this equation imposing zero curvature of L. So it's looking good. I'm kind of getting close. And you see that we should remember that when we made this change of variables, we did introduce an extra gauge symmetry. You can see that this kind of transformation where this Q group valued field is holomorphic, this sort of preserves A. Okay. So what we did we put some artificial gauge transformation. So I'm just going to integrate out u plus and u minus. So I'm just imposing these meromorphicity equations. So this is the nice thing about this approach where I put the equations of motion like I pose them with Lagrange multipliers, is you can just impose them. Because you can just solve, you can just integrate over the Lagrange multipliers. So you just solve some equations. It looks very classical, but one loop divergences are very classical objects. So I can just solve these equations. And yeah. You see in the end what you end up doing is you write L. This slide is a little unclear. As I told you before, I write the Lax connection as this sum of poles, where the poles are at the zeros of phi. And the residues of those poles are these 2D currents, which I now call curly A tilde. So tilde means 2D field. Right? These A tildes are 2D fields. And you know, in the end, in solving these equations, it just means you integrate at the end over fluctuations alpha of those 2D fields. So here, in principle, you could worry there's a Jacobian, you made some change of variables, it's a little bit complicated. But because this change of variables is linear, I'm very convinced that such a Jacobian would be constant. In other words, it doesn't depend on background fields. I'm dropping such things, as I'll comment later. So in the end, I'm integrating, you know, I've got this, my Lax connection L takes some particular fixed meromorphic form in terms of these 2D currents, right? I got that by solving these meromorphicity equations. And now I'm imposing with a Lagrange multiplier that it has zero curvature. And I'm integrating over a bunch of stuff, Lagrange multiplier, fluctuations of the 2D currents appearing in the Lax. So I'm kind of now giving a definition for this integral over Lax connections with fixed poles. And I'm still integrating over this field G, fluctuations of G, which is almost completely pure gauge. So it's not pure gauge in the sense that the boundary conditions depend on G, right? We have to deal with that. So let's split up the path integral. I'll integrate over G by sort of integrating over its values at the defects. And then I integrate over everything else, so the values in the bulk, where bulk means, you know, it's like you integrate over the field holding its value at the boundary fixed to be the thing you already integrated over. So that should be fine. And I should just comment, like, it's a bit subtle what we mean by this value at the defect. They have some complicated prescription in these papers I mentioned earlier. There is a range of different ways to do it. Roughly, you've got to take some particular combinations of the field at the defect and maybe a few derivatives in Z at the defect. And different choices of combinations that can be allowed. So that's what I mean by this P. P is poles of phi. Okay, so what's pure gauge here is not all of gamma, but it's gamma bulk. That's pure gauge. I can just fix it to be whatever I want. So for example, I just pick any smooth field configuration, which interpolates between the poles. It reaches the correct things at the P places. So I'm going to fix gamma bulk to be whatever I want. I just delete it. It doesn't appear anywhere. And you remember, I introduced this artificial gauge symmetry. It's like 2D-like gauge symmetry by the change of variables. And we don't really have to worry about it very much. What they do classically, in the papers I mentioned earlier, it also works at the quantum level. You can just fix some value of this field G at the defects. You just take some component at one of the defects. You fix it to be one. So you kind of sacrifice one defect to get rid of this gauge freedom. Conventionally, they sacrifice the defect at infinity. Basically, if you left this, you just end up with something which is invariant under the gauge transformations of the lax. It's not worth worrying about. So there are these boundary conditions, and we've got to deal with them. So my claim is that basically, under sort of basic assumptions in the typical case, what happens is that these boundary conditions, right, they just lead to some Bianchi identities for the currents appearing in the lax, these curly A's. So integrating over this stuff while imposing boundary conditions, the boundary conditions are just telling you that curly A with a tilde takes some particular form in terms of the defect values of this G field.
What is this?
So it just sort of tells you the physical form of lax currents.
And you call me first.
And now the thing is you're integrating over that G.
I wasn't calling anybody at all, but anyway.
It's fluctuation gamma. You're integrating over it. So it's like A is A of G, but we're summing over all Gs. So in the end, it just tells me that A is of some particular class. And you can convince yourself that it should be some first-order differential equation on A that's being imposed. For example, if it was like A is G inverse dG, then that would be imposing that f of a is 0. Right, when I integrate over g, this is the juice that comes out of that boundary condition. So this should be some generalization of that. OK, so I get some Bianchi identities. I can impose them again with Lagrange multipliers v. And now I'm going to make another assumption. I assume that the Bianchi identities, so this is very analogous to the assumption I had to make in 2D. I have to assume that these Bianchi identities, following from the boundary conditions, they are sort of a subset of the zero curvature equations. So in particular, they're already being imposed to vanish in the path integral that you've got. Right? So here, they're already being forced through the Lagrange multiplier. So I'm assuming now that I'm not getting any external equations of motion. I would say that boundary conditions of that type, sorry, any external Bianchi identities, I say that the boundary conditions of that type are not admissible for me. They're bad. And under that assumption, it allows me to just delete this exponential factor, right? Because the thing in the exponent is already being imposed by a Lagrange multiplier. So you end up with this. It's this volume of things solving f of L equals 0. We put this integral over v, right? And we deleted the exponent, but we're still integrating over v in some sort of, right? This integral over v. It's still going to be there, even after you delete this. But basically, there's just some gauge symmetry there, like shifting v, because v doesn't appear anywhere. So you should interpret the integral over v properly understood with gauge fixing is just 1. And this just stems from an overcounting. Like we wrote, it's our formalism is making the problem. Right, we wrote down some list of equations of motion. And it turns out that now I want to assume some of those equations of motion are actually implied by boundary conditions. Right, so but I counted them as equations of motion, so that led to an overcounting. Okay, so I just delete that factor. But you see here now, because of this assumption I made, that I get this universality that I also had in 2D. Because boundary conditions now don't appear in the path integral. And that's the thing that really differs in the different models. the ones which have the same poles in the lax connection, but they have their different theories, so they would have different boundary conditions. So here we get the universality, and this is what we get. But there's still a bit of an issue. There's still a bit more gauge symmetry to deal with. So kind of, in a way, it's obvious, right, though, because you have the same equations of motion, you're going to land on the right thing in 2D. And I guess the subtlety is just in dealing with this gauge symmetry and boundary conditions. So now, what's the problem here? We basically got what we asked for, right? The thing I kind of asked, does it make sense in 4D? It's a volume of lax connections with a fixed pole structure, right? Because I'm just integrating over the currents alpha. And I'm just imposing that the zero curvature is the volume of things solving zero curvature. But indeed, like, the thing I really get on the nose in 2D was more like this. It's a 2D Parsons score, not a 4D one. So how can I see that these things really are the same? So again, the problem is just that when we wrote down, we enumerated a list of equations of motion, some of them were, they were really 2D equations, but I imposed them like they were 4D equations. With 4D Lagrange multipliers.
Right.
So I overcounted, and equivalently, there's a gauge symmetry in this theory. So the gauge symmetry, the point is just that only certain sort of modes of this U actually appear in its action. Right. So it's the modes which, if I write the zero curvature equation with this choice of poles, there'll be some poles which appear, some functions of Z, times some 2D equations. And so these modes, these functions, they pick out certain modes of U, which are the modes which appear in this action. So equivalently, there's a gauge symmetry where you shift U by something which has zero integral against all of those functions. And you can fix a gauge very simply. Like you just pick some functions which are sort of orthogonal to this finite list of Fs, and you fix U to be just some sum of these Gs with those modes as the coefficients. So you can do that, and then you really land on exactly on the thing which I derived from a path integral in 2D. So it's again just the volume of flat connections with a given pole structure. And I convinced myself, I hope I didn't lose you on the way, I convinced myself that the on-shell one-loop effective actions are equivalent between the 4D Chan-Simons theory and these 2D theories. I had to make these sort of Bianchi completeness assumptions. And of course, just regarding measure factors, while I have been very careful about measure factors depending on background fields, because these are actually the things I want to compute, I'm dropping all measure factors which are constant. So I'm not worrying about constant measure factors which can appear from these things. I convinced myself that all of these things can only produce constant measure factors. Some choices about how you split the G field, the bulk, and the defect. And so you may say that we're dropping constant terms, constant divergent terms in the effective action, or dropping a constant overall factor in the path integral. So I think this is basically a fine thing to do. I think that overall constant term is not what we're looking for here. You might say that you might worry it's an extra divergence. 4D, 2D theories are not quite matching. But you may also say that the right prescription for the 4D measure should be to set this thing to zero. In any case, if what you care about is renormalizability and RGU flow, that is all only kind of minimally affected, right? It's just like one extra divergence. I wanted to just comment that I've treated all local symmetries of the linearized theory as gauge symmetries, and I think that's well justified. Basically because the only one which is not obvious is this overcounting type gauge symmetries. But really they came from an overcounting that I did. At some point I made some step where I introduced an extra gauge symmetry. So I think that it's very much natural to gauge. And of course one should check for their Popov determinants. They're basically all trivial, just one of them dealing with these modes of U from 4D to 2D, slightly non-trivial, but it's trivial. So indeed, the statement is the one-loop divergences of the 4D theory, they match those of the 2D theory. And this happens even despite this scary prospect of these disorder defects. So why are they scary? Why would some people have worried about them in the beginning? Because you see, phi over h bar, that's the combination that they appear in. So when phi has a zero disorder defect, it's like h bar going to infinity, right? So in principle, you might worry that the semi-classical expansion could go wrong due to some contributions from these dangerous points. So then you might think, okay, maybe the one loop term will be like extremely big or something, but it's not. You know, it's the one loop term is fine. It's just the same as these 2D theories, which are perfectly fine theories. Maybe it could go wrong at higher loop orders. Maybe the effects of these disorder defects would show themselves at higher loops. So time is very, we should stop on the hour, I suppose.
Yes, I'm gonna get it.
So I'll try to just wrap up. So here, I had this unifying approach, you know, these universal formulas in 2D. And there are also some other kind of unifying approaches, which people have written down, sort of extrapolating from some cases. They made this conjecture. You can try and, they tried to write the RG flow as some flow of this function, phi. And there's also a conjecture in 4D of Derry Berry, and he sort of quoted Kevin as the author of this conjecture. So it's a conjecture about the flows of the periods of this meromorphic one form in 4D. So that's a way to write down the flow. And so the purpose of this paper with Anders and Sylvain is that we see, so now that we know, I mean, I know now, I convince myself that under certain assumptions, the flow matches between 2D and 4D. So now I can start drawing arrows. I can start saying, you know, extrapolating. So I just try and write these universal formulas, right? Remember I had this slick formula. I write that as a 4D, some 4D term. And our claim is that, you know, all of these things are all equivalent. So it's nice to see that. It's nice to see that everything agrees. So maybe one could try to really understand, like the kind of things you were saying, Davide, trying to understand this 4D theory, you know, in 4D. What I did, it's a bit like a cheat. I just make a transformation to 2D. Maybe indeed one can just quantize it in 4D and compute these one-loop divergences there. It would be nice to understand it properly.
Remind me, this cloth move the poles, or it doesn't move it?
Yeah, they move. Yeah.
Is that the moves?
Yeah.
Off
it's a bit bizarre. Yeah. So the message is that the one-loop divergences match. And so I think, you know, I convinced myself, although maybe I was actually skeptical about a year ago, I convinced myself that you should take this correspondence between the 4D tensimons and these non-ultra-local 2D integral models seriously at the quantum level. Like, one loop is like the most significant thing. You know, it's scheme invariant, blah blah blah. It's really it's good that it matches. And just at the level of these 2D models, you learn that integrability does indeed constrain the RG flow. There's this universal structure, it's pretty rigid. And I was able to derive that from 4D. So there are many future directions. I have about four future direction slides. An interesting thing is that with these integrable sigma models, we found in some earlier work that this property of renormalizability, which we think is really is due to integrability, in order for it to happen at higher loop orders, generically, you need to add alpha prime corrections to the target spaces. So alpha prime is like h bar for the sigma model. And so this is natural. It's just like, you know, you should expect finite counter terms to be needed as far as they're consistent with symmetry. And as long as the global symmetries don't forbid them, then maybe the correct kind of bare Lagrangian should have some alpha prime corrections, should generically need them to be consistent with integrability. And you know, the presence of these alpha prime corrections, it's not just a scheme artifact. There's no covariant scheme where they go away. So maybe you could hope to try and derive them from 4D, right? If you could try and follow through the arguments I've made here, but including a few quantum corrections. So not just one loop divergences, but higher loops. Maybe you could derive these other quantum corrections. And as I said, it would be interesting to sort of do some computation directly in 4D. Of course, so here we're learning something about a universal structure of these one loop divergences. Perhaps one could actually prove this conjecture, that the integrable models are stable under the RG flow. And you know, it would be mathematically probably quite a deep statement. It brings together two, as far as I know, distinct areas. There's this integrable harmonic map problem, and there's the Ricci flow. These are sort of deep objects. And it would be interesting if there was this, it would be a deep mathematical connection between them. That if geometries with this, where the harmonic map problem is integrable, would happen to have to be closed under Ricci flow, would be something interesting. So now, of course, one can turn to string theory and ask, you know, have we learned anything? So, yeah, there are these eta lambda deformations. They also have analogs for the ADS5S5 string. You can deform it with these things. And you basically keep the pole structure, some Z4 coset structure, fixed, and you just modify what the currents are, which appear these curly A's in my notation. And the kind of amazing fact, which nobody explained and nobody even asked why it's true, is that sometimes what you get is still a supergravity solution. So the target space still solves the supergravity equations. A priori, why should it happen? Why should random integrable deformations of an integrable model, why should they be marginal? And modulo some, you have to make some assumption in some case. There's this unimodularity condition. And I say the answer is probably something about the integrability, controlling which divergences can appear. At the level of the scale anomaly, which is a bit coarse, you can just see it straight away. It all follows because the divergences will just take this universal structure and some group theoretic number, CG, is zero in that case, just from supersymmetry. We kind of already knew that, actually, because these things preserve kappa symmetry, and kappa symmetry implies scaling. Yeah, what's really interesting is the Weyl anomaly, because the Weyl anomaly coefficients are proportional to the supergravity equations. So, you know, can you get some universal way, using these kind of techniques, to compute the Weyl anomaly in terms of the lax? And you should see, indeed, it's not universal because there was this extra unimodularity condition, but you know, can you compute the unimodularity condition, the condition for solving supergravity from these considerations and generalize it, you know, to all other cases? The final slide, I won't go in detail, but just to say, basically, these formulas also work for the Sine-Gordon model, and I think it's because this all commutes with Polmeyer reduction. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yeah, actually, so I didn't put it because it just seemed like too much, but here, actually, this all, I think, you know, these guys have this work they're doing with elliptic spectral parameter, and I think this all, insofar as we can check things, it all goes through also with elliptic. Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. If you put Wilson lines in 4D, I'm really not an expert here, but if you put Wilson lines, then you can start building lattice models. And so this is the story, I guess, it's in the first paper of Kevin Witten Yamazaki. And there are some R matrices when the Wilson lines cross. But and indeed, there's some picture where, which I don't understand well, where these kind of defects here can be built by making some squashing together some dense bunch of Wilson lines. So I don't know. Yeah, would be interesting to try and, I don't know, Kevin, do you have some comments?
Are we almost able to do that, like,
So I'm going to be using the basis of representation of the Jungian, scattering the matrix of the Jungian into clutter. It's pretty hard on the Jungian into clutter. But, you know, my tensor product representations, it's normally it's irreducible. So this that's the market function. It's not very satisfying.
Sometimes you can take all the models and like the equations, things like that, and have to look at the parametric flow from that perspective.
Right.
Any connections? It's like you want to correspond then.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. But to write down TBA equations, you need an S matrix.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any particular comments, but it's interesting. I think people have done something like this. In some cases, people did some, worked out some computations explicitly. Like, you start from TBA equations and extract some perturbative stuff, a beta function. I don't know. Thanks.